Thank you, Hannah. I think your heart captured the spirit of those words. So we're in the middle of an Old Testament series on the period of the exile, meaning the long period of time that takes place from when the Israelites were in Babylon right through until the time of Jesus. And most people think that this period of exile is short, but it's not. It's longer than all the years that the nation of Israel was a kingdom. The Hebrews spent more time without a king than they did with a king. During exile, much of what they held dear was much of what was dear to them was stripped away from them, their national identity and their temple and their homeland. And they had a lot to say about the situation. A large portion of our Old Testament was written and compiled during this time, and it's all deeply colored by the pain and the struggle of the exile. And their words left a huge legacy. And one of the great blessings of this period is the preservation of the thoughts and the feelings of the Jewish people as they lived through this long crisis. And to help you better understand all that I'm going to teach today and work through, I want to give you a little micro-Bible lesson. And it will set up what we're going to talk about in the book of Ecclesiastes today. So the Old Testament has three parts, and they need to be read and understood differently, each of these three parts. And if you ask any Jew, they will know this, but as evangelicals, we can make the mistake of thinking that all 39 books are the same, but that's not quite right. So the first part is the Pentateuch. It's the law, often called the Book of Moses, and it's the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And then second, we have the prophets. And in these books, the prophets constantly call God's people back. The prophets are saying, interpret all you are seeing and experiencing in this world through God's lens. That's what they're saying. You exist as a people to represent God to the world. And as God's people, live like God's people. And third is the writings. And they are different than the law and the prophets. The Jewish Bible organizes the books in these three sections, the Pentateuch, the prophets, and then the writings. This makes a lot of sense the way it's organized, because the writings are inspired human responses to the first two sections. The law, this is how you live, God is just. The prophets, you aren't following God's law, come back to God, here are the consequences if you don't. And then third, the law and the prophets are both speaking to people. Don't do this. Don't be this way. And then third, we have the writings, and that they come along and there are conversation that reverses. And in these books, people respond back to God. Here, humans have a chance to give their two cents. They get to tell God how they feel about God's ways and the world system that God created. Many of these writers are wrestling with God's ways. Some are wondering whether faithfulness and wisdom pay out as the prophets promised it would. And some of these writers are God's accusers. And because these writers have been given the chance to freely express their thoughts and opinions, these books are rich. These men were brutally honest about how they felt. They didn't hold anything back. Some of these writers were angry and hurting, and it comes through in their words like we heard today. Sometimes the writings challenge God, and they argue with God and tell God that God isn't doing a good job at running things. And some accuse God of even deeper crimes like the writer of Ecclesiastes does, who we're going to hear from in a minute. Now, it's quite remarkable that these men were given a voice. Their thoughts have been immortalized forever. Everywhere the law of God is read, it's accompanied by the human response to it, which in some places lashes out against God. And their voices cry out from the grave, thousands of years after their bodies have turned to dust. Time should have done away with all of God's ancient accusers, but it hasn't. Because their thoughts and their feelings about the way God acts in the world have been preserved. And not just preserved, these words have been treasured. Think about what this says about our God. Our holy book isn't a one-way conversation. God gives his people a voice, even when it conflicts with God's message. It's quite amazing, because words are so powerful. They can cause heaps of trouble. And more than that, when you give someone a voice, it's one of the greatest dignities that you can show to somebody. The thoughts of these men will be remembered for as long as the law is remembered. What kind of king does this? Certainly, no human king would ever do this. But that's not the only thing that's remarkable about these writings. It's remarkable that the human editors of the Bible allowed this to happen. It's easy to think that the Bible just dropped out of heaven in its current form, but we know it didn't. Human editors compiled it. And we believe this happened under divine guidance. And these particular books are one of the reasons why we believe that God guided the process. Somehow these editors resisted the urge to turn the Bible into a tool of religious propaganda. Propaganda pushes one agenda and silences opposing voices. But the scriptures and Judaism don't do that. This is one of the reasons that the Old Testament is widely respected. It also makes it unique among religious writings. So before we get into the book, I need to address one issue that some of you will already have clued into. According to tradition, this book was written by King Solomon. And if it was written by King Solomon, why would we be talking about it in an exile series when the exile began about 400 years after Solomon was king? And the reason people think it was written by Solomon is because the unnamed teacher describes himself as if he's Solomon. In chapter 1, it says he's the son of David, king of Jerusalem. And then in chapter 2, he basically describes all the things that Solomon was. I was wiser than anyone, a great builder of buildings. I had great wealth and a great harem. Though he didn't say, I'm Solomon, it appears that he surely must be. But there's a really big reason why he couldn't have been Solomon. And that's revealed by the language that's used to write it. Language analysis is always a key part of dating any writing. Language scholars know this book is from the period of the exile because it contains Aramaic words. The language of the Israelites was Hebrew. And Aramaic was the language of the Babylonians. Jerusalem was 1,500 kilometers away from Babylon. And all the books that were written before exile are written in pure Hebrew. And many of those written during or after exile contain Aramaic words. Because the Hebrews, they picked up Aramaic while they were in Babylon. Large portions of Daniel were written in Aramaic, for example. So let me use a modern example to explain this. Most of you know the word groovy. The word was created in the 1920s, but it became common in speech and in writing in the 1960s. Now, if a book has the word groovy in it, it helps to date it. The book might be from the 1920s, but most likely it's from the 1960s when the word was most heavily used, and it's probably not from the 1980s or onward after the word fell out of use. But there's one thing we know for absolute sure, and that's the book is not from before 1920, because the word groovy didn't exist then. In the same way, we know Solomon didn't write Ecclesiastes because some of the words that are used to write it didn't exist in the Hebrew language in 940 BC. It's impossible. So because of this, it's believed that the teacher in Ecclesiastes wrote in the voice of Solomon to emphasize his connection to the wisdom tradition. And that's the simple answer. And if you want more detail, Jamie or I would be happy to lend you a commentary and you can read more about it. Basically, what the teacher is saying by writing in the voice of Solomon is, listen to me, I'm wise. He's not some random guy who's got a bone to pick with God. He's someone who has pursued wisdom and somebody who's achieved it. He's someone who is respected. And we know this must be true, because if he wasn't, his book wouldn't have made it into the Bible. He's important and he's wise, but he's definitely not Solomon. So using someone else's identity is something that people did in ancient writings. They took on someone else's name to make a point. This happened more than once. And if someone did this today, it would feel like deception, but in ancient times, this would be a normal thing to do. So this shouldn't bother us at all, because if it's okay with God, it needs to be okay with us, and certainly God is fine with it. And one final important point before we dig in. Don't let me lose you. One final point. This book has two voices. The main voice we hear is through the book. That's the main voice. He's called the teacher. And there's also a narrator. And it's important that we recognize this narrator, because at the end, the narrator is going to critique the teacher. So the narrator opens the book. The words of Ecclesiastes. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. And then the teacher is given his say. Reading from verse 2. Meaningless, meaningless, utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. He's laying it all out there. This is what he's doing by starting like this. He's saying, I'm not messing around here. Just let's get to the heart of it now. Let's talk about real life. So we translate this Hebrew word, hevel, as meaningless. And it's a big word with a deep meaning. The opening sentence could also be translated, life is dumb. Life is stupid. Life is an affront to reason. Life is senseless. Life is futile. Life is the most absurd thing. This man is taking God to task for the way the world is ordered. And now I'm going to move past where Hannah read, reading from verse 13. I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. The teacher's going to explain how he came to this conclusion we just heard from Hannah. The teacher went on what we would call an existential quest. Some of you will have studied existentialism in high school or university. It's the study of human existence, and it asks all of the big questions. Why do we exist? What is our purpose? What's the meaning of life? These are existential questions. I'm sure all of us have asked some of these questions at one point in our life. The teacher was pursuing answers to these questions. First, he looked for meaning in everything that life has to offer. In verse 2:10, he says, I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. He tells us he tried partying, wine and laughter, and silliness, but that didn't work. He tried sex. He had a harem. He tried materialism. He built great things, houses and vineyards, and he bought male and female slaves, and he had huge herds and flocks, but that gave life no meaning. And then he thinks, maybe wisdom is the answer. Or maybe it's better to be the fool. But then he came to the conclusion that in the end, both of these end up dead. And because of this, there was no benefit to putting the hard work in that all the hard work in that wisdom takes. So then he investigated work. Chapter 2, 17 through 20. So I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun. And this here coming up is why he is so down on work. Because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish. Yet they will have control over all the fruit of my toil, into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. So my heart began to despair over my toilsome labor under the sun. Sorry if you came in here in a good mood. The teacher is a real cup half empty kind of guy. He hates his work because all that he created can be undone by the one who follows him. Who knows whether they will make a mess of what he's just created? And I'm sure everyone who's retired has thought the same thing. But he's not just thinking about his work. He watches everyone at work and then makes this summary. Not just him, this is everybody. He says, all their days, their work is grief and pain. Even at night, their minds do not rest. This too is meaningless. Work in grief and pain during the day, and then when it comes time for work to end, time for rest and for sleep, our minds won't let us. we worry pointlessly. This too is meaningless, he says. I have to agree with him. Then chapter 3, 9 through 10. What do workers gain from their toil? I have seen the burden that God has laid on the human race. What do workers gain from their toil? This is a fair question. Many people on earth work very hard and barely survive. It seems to be getting more and more like that here in Canada as well. Many of us struggle to stay on top of our bills. For some, living longer means growing in debt. Life can easily seem to be a lot of hard work with very little reward. And then he says, he has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the human heart. Yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. Don't be confused by the word beautiful. He's not changing his direction here. The teacher is explaining that the world is beautifully ordered. Everything is woven together exquisitely. There is an elegance to creation. By saying this, he's acknowledging that this is God's world. We are living in a natural system that God created. The sun rises and sets every day. The seasons come and go year after year. Generations pass. Life repeats. All things live. All things die. But as humans, we have an infuriating role in it. Unlike animals who don't understand the system God has set eternity in our hearts. We understand at least part of what's going on, much more than all the other creatures on the earth. We know that time began before us and that it will continue after we're gone. We have a sense of past and future, and we know that we exist. We're aware of our Creator. And unlike all other creatures, we have the ability to change our circumstances and control our thoughts. But it's a limited ability. We don't know how to make sense of it all. He's saying we have too much understanding. We can observe and know what's going on, but we have too little power. Only God understands everything that is really going on. For our entire life, we will be struggling against limited knowledge, frustrated by our limits. And this man, he is mad. Because this is God's intention from the start, that we would have limits. That we would be a little like God, but with limited power and knowledge. And this isn't good enough for the teacher. He's taking God on. He's taking him to task for the way that the world is ordered. And after all this, this is the summary that he makes. God has given us limited power and knowledge. And during life, we have to work really hard. Life is hard. Life is full of pain. And after we've had our turn in the system, after we've made our little mark on the world, we die and we lose full control of it all. That's the order of things. And the teacher thinks that the entire system is cruel. Here's what he tells us to do based on all of that knowledge. I know that there is nothing better for them than to be happy and enjoy themselves as long as they live. It is God's gift that we should all eat and drink and take pleasure in our toil. After all his decades of searching to make sense of life, the teacher decides that the best response to this unfair situation is just to try to be happy and enjoy life. Eat and drink, which means gather with people and celebrate life the best you can, find meaning in relationships and make them count and take pleasure in your work. Do the best you can with the little time that you have on earth, and that is where he lands. So as we read this, we need to remember that this is a human response to God. This is human wisdom, a very wise human being's wisdom. He's saying, well, this is the way things are in the world, so this is the best you can do with your life. But this book has a narrator. And the narrator has an inspired response. He's not going to let the teacher have the last word on this one very important topic in the book. So the narrator has four quick things that he wants to say. Reading from chapter 12, verse 9 to 13. Not only was the teacher wise, but he also imparted knowledge to the people. He pondered and searched out and said in order many proverbs. The teacher searched to find just the right words, and what he wrote was upright and true. First, the narrator teaches us says that the teacher is very wise. And what's written here will be a great help to the Jews, and it was a great help to the Jews. The teacher, he was careful with his words, and they do contain much wisdom, and his assessment of the world is fair. The world is what he says. All the proverbs that are contained within this book, most of which we didn't touch during this very short sermon, are solid. Follow them. Do what he says in his proverbs. Reading from verse 11. The words of the wise are like goads, their collected sayings like firmly embedded nails given by one shepherd. Second point. The goad is the thing that the shepherds use to poke the sheep to get them to move. And sometimes shepherds put nails in them to get the sheep to move. And that was kind of cruel and hard, but it hurt. And so what the narrator is saying that is that what the teacher is saying is true, and sometimes truth hurts. Don't shy away from it just because it hurts. Next verse. Be warned, my son, of anything in addition to them. Of making many books, there is no end, and much study wearies the body. Here's his third point. For those of you who are inclined to think like the teacher and want to search out answers to big questions, for those of you who wonder about the world and want to make sense of it, you need to know that this man, he was brilliant. This man was inspired. So you will seek and study, but in the end, you will get no further than him. If he can't figure it out, then neither can you. Don't do it. The search will destroy your joy. Save yourself the effort. Be wise. Just read this book. That's what he's saying. And then here's the narrator's final point, and it's the really important last word on the writings of the teacher. Now all that has been heard, here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the duty of all mankind. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. So here the narrator becomes a prophet who steps in to say the final word, and he makes one slight correction. Not on the teacher's analysis of the world, but on the teacher's conclusion about to what to do about what he knows. The teacher has said, eat, drink, and be happy. This is the whole duty of mankind. Do this to numb yourself against the absurdity of life and death. But the prophet says, no. Fear God and keep his commandments. This is the duty of mankind. Now that you know all the teacher has shown you, everything that he has revealed to you, serve God anyway. Don't spend your life on the pursuit of pleasure. Don't give yourself over to eat, drink, and be happy. The teacher's response is the wrong response to the realities of life. The world may feel unjust and evil, but God will bring all things into light. Nothing is hidden from God. Evil will be dealt with. Basically, God can be trusted with the order of the world. God can be trusted. For those of you who are here today who agree with the teacher that life is truly absurd, this book wants you to get to the place where you can say, but I'm going to fear God and keep the commandments anyway. Or to use New Testament Christian language, no matter how bad things get, even if life continues to be hard until the day I die, I'm going to keep trusting in Jesus. I will follow Jesus anyway. So if the message of this book seems too dark, that means it's not written for you. It's written to people who have suffered through exile. It's written for any of us who have become disappointed or disillusioned with life. It's written for those who don't like the way that God has ordered the world. These people need to know how to move forward. And if you're thinking, wow, that's not my experience of life, I think life's pretty great, then just let that book and this sermon pass you by, and the book will be waiting for you if your experience of life changes. For those of you who have ever felt that life is meaningless or absurd or dumb or stupid or an affront to reason or senseless or futile, you have been given an audience with the Creator. God hears your cry, and God honors it. You don't have to pretend you're happy about life. God honors your truth. And if you can get to the place where you say, I will follow Jesus anyway, then your faith has matured. You've arrived at the place where you can let God be God. Your faith has stopped being about you and your experience of life. You have centered your life around God, not around yourself. You're allowing God to be creator, and you accept that you are the created one. If you get to this place, you have learned that you can rest in the hands of God. Life can be falling down all around you, and you can be at peace. You may not be happy about what's going on. Of course you're not. Why should you be? But you rest in the knowledge that God is worth serving anyway, even if life is disappointing from beginning to end. Let's pray together. Lord, there are some here in this room who have had a very hard time with life. Thank you for giving them an advocate in this book of Ecclesiastes. Thank you for showing them a way forward, a way to continue to serve you through their pain. Thank you for not making us pretend. Help us to come to the place where we can respond by declaring that we will follow you anyway. Show us the way, Jesus. Show us your way. Amen.